You're listening to the Diplomats Podcast on Asian Geopolitics. As always, I'm your host, Ankit Panda, recording here in Washington, D.C. And I'm very happy today to be joined by a special guest, a longtime friend and an analyst that I've read for a very long time to wrap my head around anything and everything going on in Japanese politics. Joining me today is Tobias Harris, who writes the excellent Observing Japan Substack blog. Tobias, thanks a lot for taking the time to join me today.
Thanks, Ankit. It's really great to be back here. Great to be talking with you again.
Yeah, so, you know, I mentioned Japanese politics, and it's been kind of a whirlwind of about a week or so. I actually just got back from Tokyo. I was there before the elections, before the trade deal nonsense kind of played out, and got a little bit of a taste of the, I guess you could say, trepidation in the air about both of those things in Tokyo. And of course, we've gotten some really interesting developments on both those fronts. But I want to start first with the elections. Pretty big deal. Lack of a majority for the historically dominant Liberal Democratic Party in both houses of the Japanese National Diet. Tell us a bit about how that happened and why it matters.
Yeah, so, you know, in some ways you got to rewind to last year when you had a change of prime minister. You got Prime Minister Ishiba Shigeru taking over from his predecessor Kishida Fumio after winning a pretty narrow leadership election. And then pretty quickly going right into a snap election last October that went very poorly for the Liberal Democratic Party. They, of course, with their coalition partner Komeito, fell short of a majority by roughly around nine or 10 seats now. And so that has meant, so you've had essentially a minority government because, you know, ultimately, you know, you really need you need control of the lower house to do a lot and certainly to pass a budget. And so essentially the government's had governed by negotiation since October, working on an issue by issue basis with the opposition parties. And of course, so what was at stake heading into this upper house election, so Japan has upper house elections every 3 years for half the house, was control of the upper house, because if without control of the upper house, you really have a true, genuine minority government situation where everything has to be negotiated. And what happened was the ruling coalition did in fact fall just short by three seats short of retaining its majority in the upper house. And so now you have this situation where you have control, the LDP and its partner Komeito have do not have control of either house of the diet. And not only that, you have a sense of, you know, Ishiba has now led the LDP and Komeito to two straight electoral defeats. It's generally something the LDP is not going to be very tolerant of. There's a feeling that the LDP really has lost the country. Ishiba has lost control of his party. And for the moment, he is holding on to power, but he is under extraordinary pressure to go.
Yeah, so, you know, I'll just say we're having this conversation on July 25th, U.S. Eastern Time during the day. So it's possible that by the time this releases, we might have a change in the situation. So, you know, what's your read on what's likely to happen just, you know, on the other side of the weekend with Ishiba's political fate?
So there was it's been a confusing week on that front, because there was a report Wednesday. Well, I guess it dropped Wednesday morning in Japan, late Tuesday here on the East Coast, that Ishiba actually had communicated to people at his circle that he intended to resign. And in fact, I got called out of bed to go on TV and talk about it. And then very quickly, a few hours later, Ishiba said, no, that report's not true. Other papers have suggested that he did say that. But right now he's digging in his heels, and he has said he is not leaving. He's going to fight on. And he apparently told a bunch of opposition party leaders that he intends to stay on. But in the meantime, you have essentially an anti-Ishiba movement that is picking up steam within the LDP. You've had, I think in some ways the most worrying sign for him is that you've had, you know, so the LDP has local chapters in each of Japan's 47 prefectures, and something like, we're almost at 10 now, have formally said that he needs to go. And of course those matter because they actually have a vote, you know, like if it comes to a vote whether you should get rid of him or not, the heads of those chapters have a vote. So gotcha. People are watching those very closely. And of course the prefectural chapters are much closer to voters and are very aware of what LDP supporters are thinking about this whole thing. And so there's a lot of discontent. There is a growing movement of lawmakers putting together a petition that would force the LDP to consider having an early leadership election, which is basically the main mechanism for forcing out a leader. And the goal is to get enough people to sign that petition where it looks like if that were to happen, Ishibo would have no chance of winning, and to basically force him to see the writing on the wall and to go. The prime minister seems to think that somehow he can kind of, he can just get through this, and somehow he has the votes, and basically in some ways seems to be trying to call the bluff of his opponents, that basically, like, if you have the votes, then show me. You know, that if you, if there are enough votes to get rid of me, then fine, then I'll go. But until then, I'm not leaving. I'm the prime minister. Yeah. So that's kind of where things are now, that Ishibo doesn't have a whole lot of people really coming out to defend him, although I guess there's been a hashtag campaign telling him not to resign because people don't want the LDP moving to the right. And there was, I guess, a small demonstration in his favor on Friday night in Tokyo. But his situation isn't good, and it really just seems a matter of, you know, his opponents just have to show they have the numbers, and then he's gone.
Yeah, so I want to come to the geopolitics, you know, and the geopolitical implications in a second, but I do want to ask you about the other parties outside of the LDP Kumeito coalition, because there's been, of course, quite a bit of interest in the Sanseito party, the kind of right-wing, I guess I've seen the Trumpist descriptor. You can tell us if that's a good one or not. How much did that kind of harm the LDP on sort of the getting some of those traditional, I guess, right-wing voters that might have gone LDP in previous years? Because Sanseito has been really building its profile in Japan. So do you see that as kind of significant? And you know, what should our listeners know about the role of this party in Japanese politics going forward?
Well, I mean, in general, part of the problem the LDP has had over the last couple election cycles, or at least this is, you know, an argument that the right wing of the LDP is making, that a number of the party's more conservative supporters have been dismayed at what they see as a liberal turn since the late Abe Shinzo was assassinated. Basically, the party has abandoned his successful record and his policies under Kishida and Ishiba, and therefore in elections it has lost more right-wing LDP voters to some of these upstart parties on the right. And so, and in some ways, actually, the more significant is not Sanseito. I mean, I'll talk about Sanseito momentarily, but more significant has been the Democratic Party for the People, which is a splinter of the late and I guess relatively unlamented Democratic Party of Japan, and it is led by a somewhat charismatic sort of social media savvy guy, Tamaki Yuichiro. So they had a really big election last year. They really saw a big increase in their votes and their seats, and so they really became a player in, you know, figuring out how the LDP was going to run the Diet. And they had at least as big a performance this time around. I mean, in some ways were the real big gainers, just in terms of how many seats they picked up, the kind of elections, the seats that they won. They really were quite successful, and they really saw another big boost in their nationwide support. And so they're really in some ways the party to watch, because also since Sanseito doesn't really have much of a presence in the lower house, so it's not really as much of a factor in terms of just figuring out how the country is going to be governed compared to Tamaki and the Democratic Party for the People. So they're in some ways the party to on the right to watch more, because they're hawkish on national defense. Like the right wing of the LDP, they're very fiscally dovish. They basically want a lot more tax cuts and a lot more stimulus, and, you know, kind of neo-Abenomics, you know, sort of more dovish everything in terms of stimulating the economy. Tamaki on the campaign trail at one point was talking about, you know, need for a new three arrows, you know, trying to peel off some of those, you know, Abe loyal voters. So that's the problem. Sanseito is a threat maybe in a different way, because, I mean, yes, I think they peeled off some LDP supporters, but also they brought a lot of young, previously disconnected voters out to the polls to vote for them.
Is this sort of the right-wing Gen Z phenomenon that's kind of sweeping the world? Yeah.
Yes. I mean, and the DPFP too has the same, you know, it consistently polls well among young voters. I mean, they've very much leaned into, you know, trying to appeal to kind of urban young working class voters who have been neglected by the political system. Their interests haven't been served. You know, they have seen their disposable income shrink, and so really trying to appeal to those voters. I mean, what is new about Sanseito, and what has attracted, I think, more attention, is that, you know, they have made kind of xenophobia and wanting restrictions on Japan's growing foreign population. They've made that as part of their pitch to voters in a way that parties just haven't before. Mm-hmm. And they really put the issue of Japan's foreign population on the electoral agenda in a way that just, I mean, every party was forced to have something to say about it. But I think the importance of it, of the issue and of Sanseito's xenophobic appeals, I think can be overstated. I mean, when you look at exit polls, I mean, this was overwhelmingly an election that was about inflation, that was about, you know, whether there should be a consumption tax cut that would leave more, you know, put more money in people's pockets. That was overwhelmingly the most important issue. You know, basically, I mean, I saw one exit poll that said that even foreign policy was a more important issue to voters than the foreign population question. So, yeah. You know, this is, you know, we, you know, I think outside of Japan, this has gotten a lot of attention, but we shouldn't overstate the actual importance that this played in the election itself.
Great. No, that's exactly the kind of insight that I think is very helpful, because you're right. I mean, you know, I think it is tempting for everybody to try and slot any development in any democracy these days into the kind of Trump framing. So that's really useful context. All right. I want to pivot a little bit to the geopolitical side of this. And I think, you know, you just said it. This wasn't an election about foreign policy or national defense or geopolitics or nuclear weapons or anything like that. But, you know, Japan is obviously an incredibly relevant player in Northeast Asia. And I think the big concern and question that I think many people have now is this election essentially a harbinger of a politically confused Japan that is going to be unable to really implement kind of, you know, if I can put it this way, the promise of the 2022 national security strategy, which was this sort of, you know, sea change in how Japan under the Kishida government articulated its aspirations, not only on national defense, but the role that it wanted to play in its alliance with the United States in Northeast Asia. I know it's very early days, and we, of course, don't know what Japan's constellation of leadership is going to look like. But How much of a ripple effect do you think this election is going to have on Japan's identity as a geopolitical player in Northeast Asia?
Well, I think before even getting into that, I mean, I think there's been a palpable sense that under Ishiba's leadership, Japan has taken a step back,
yeah.
That he's been more preoccupied with, you know, just the challenges of
Trump.
Preoccupied also just with, like, he managing the diet, you know, he's yeah. having good, you know, spent a lot of time negotiating with other parties just to get things done. And, you know, I think, you know, there's a lot of criticism of his diplomatic abilities, you know, that, you know, he's had these kind of viral moments, you know, where he's doing something embarrassing at a summit, or, you know, I think the right wing has been particularly critical of how he's managed relationship with Trump, you know, particularly compared to Abe. I mean, I think some of that comparison, I think, can be overstated, but there's something to it that Ishiba, before becoming prime minister, you know, had never really had much international experience, you know, hadn't been had been a defense minister, but actually quite a long time in the past. You know, was not really someone who, you know, Kishida, for example, you know, had been Japan's longest serving foreign minister. Abe, of course, you know, had been prime minister before, you know, had a lot of international relationships that, you know, served him well. I think, you know, just generally had, you know, a kind of diplomatic sense and a friendliness that served him well as prime minister. Ishiba didn't really have that kind of experience, and I think at times that has shown, and he's attracted a lot of criticism for that. So that was already something that he's had to deal with in terms of being seen as an effective leader internationally. It's interesting, you know, it's not that geopolitics definitely was not absent from the campaign. Mm-hmm. Ishiba really actually, almost to a remarkable extent, actually, if you watch his stump speeches, he was constantly talking about Russia's invasion of Ukraine, actually, and talking about, you know, as a kind of reminder or symbol of how dangerous the world is. You know, he would like do this thing, we'd talk about the Russia's invasion of Ukraine, then talk about North Korea's participation in Russia's invasion of Ukraine, then talk about, you know, the sort of ongoing North Korea missile threat and Russia and North Korea cooperating.
Well, he's sort of borrowing from Kishida's, you know, Ukraine today might be East Asia tomorrow kind of framing, which very much is resonating.
Very much bringing that forward. You know, remarkably too, it's like China was not discussed very much.
Right.
You know, like I there was this leaders debate before the campaign officially started, and I don't know if China was mentioned once, which you would think, given yeah, the outsized role that China plays in America. But you would think like China, oh, they would, it would be China this and China that. And if anything, China probably came up more in terms of the kind of foreign population problem, because you've had this influx of Chinese coming and buying property in Tokyo, and you like can't buy an apartment in central Tokyo now because, you know, they come in with cash and they bid it up. So, I mean, it is interesting that domestically there's just much more talk about Russia and North Korea, at least from the LDP. And of course, the United States did play a factor during the campaign, as was a factor in the campaign as well, in that Ishiba had this moment that briefly stirred things up, where he talked about how, you know, he was gonna, you know, take a tough line in the negotiations with Trump, and, you know, he was not gonna let Japan be treated with contempt, and, you know, that you know, this was after the letter that said, you know, Japan would face tariffs.
Yeah, that was my first day in Tokyo. I landed the day that letter dropped, and I think the reaction was very much, you know, a mixture of anger, fear, and humiliation, I think is the right way to describe it.
Yeah, I mean, there's no, you know, and that actually has really been the story since April 2nd. You know, it's really just been a feeling of, you know, the U.S. is, you know, how could they have done this to us? You know, we're a reliable ally. We've, you know, done what they've asked for on defense. You know, we've been the largest provider of FDI into the United States for years. Like, you know, there was, I think, a real feeling of, you know, is this any way to treat an ally? And I think maybe it took a while to really come around to the reality of what negotiating with this administration, certainly this time around, has entailed. And, you know, maybe if you want, we can talk a little bit about what was agreed this week. But I mean, I think, you know, this was a real challenge for Ishiba. And I don't think it's done him any political favors. No. You know, I think even though he in some ways maybe got the best agreement he could get, I don't think anyone on the, you know, any voters were saying, well, you've done a good job. You know, we thank you for holding out for a good agreement. I don't think he got any credit.
I mean, politically, it's almost impossible for any leader to, any leader that's accountable to a public that's dealing with the U.S. right now on trade to get that kind of an outcome that's going to really, you know, get you a round of applause back home, so to speak. But, you know, I mean, I guess what's interesting for me is I got the sense that Tokyo was pretty pleased when, you know, Ishiba came to Washington pretty early on and they had that summit where, you know, I don't know about you, but it seemed like that joint statement that came out was pretty much written in Tokyo and just handed to the U.S. team that they just signed off. And I think the Japanese were very pleased with that as evidence of just like, you know, the ability to manage the United States. But I guess that was the illusion that I guess many countries kind of talked themselves into early on, that you could manage this. I mean, for a while, I think Japan was the best ally to handle Trump, or at least handle Trump the least poorly, especially compared to the Europeans and certainly the South Koreans, who basically had nobody at the steering wheel after the martial law crisis for a while. But let's talk a bit about this trade deal, because that's also, you know, in the news, and I think very much relevant, because it's, of course, you know, driving the markets here in the United States, where there's a degree of optimism about the contours of the deal with Japan. What do you think this kind of, you know, I mean, first of all, I mean, how durable is this? That's kind of the question with anything that Trump does these days, because, you know, we've gone back and forth on tariffs. And the question now is, are these deals going to stick around? And then what's been the kind of political resonance in Japan?
Yeah. So, I mean, on the one hand, the fact that Japan did get the Trump administration to reduce automobile tariffs to 15% looks like a victory for Ishiba, you know, that he made very clear early in negotiations. This is, you know, we cannot accept, you know, 25%.
Yeah, that was the big existential question for the Japanese auto industry. So,
yeah, that they, like, this is not acceptable. Like, we cannot make a deal that that does not reduce this. And, you know, the reciprocal tariffs were sort of the next priority down. But I mean, really, it was like the automobile industry desperately needs this. And so, you know, the fact, and frankly, I mean, there were very few signs that the Trump administration was willing to discuss it at all. I mean, that it seemed very clear that, you know, to the extent that anything is clear, that like they actually liked the auto tariffs, you know, that they thought that this would, you know, really force manufacturers to move to the United States. And, you know, that ultimately, if the goal is reducing trade imbalances, getting, you know, making it harder for Americans to buy stuff from other countries is one way to do that. And they seem pretty, you know, at least the Lutnick view seemed to have the upper hand. And so the fact that, And interestingly, of course, when Trump announced it, he did not mention that, you know, it took the Japanese government, you know, at, you know, basically clarifying, like, yes, they agreed to reduce the automobile tariffs. The problem is that every kind of every day since the agreement was announced, like, it's become progressively more opaque. So, you know, now the question is, like, the, you know, in Japan, they're saying, like, well, we want something in writing. Like, we don't want you, like, we can't, like, this sort of, like, oral handshake agreement. Like,
right.
You know, also because, you know, one of the things that I think has really led to a lot of the distrust and the anger felt in Japan is that supposedly there was a handshake deal between Abe and Trump in 2019 that said if, you know, Japan agrees to, you know, this bilateral FTA, that the U.S. would then not impose automobile tariffs on Japan in the future. And so when those automobile tariffs were announced, there was a real feeling that Trump had broken his promise to Abe, you know. So, like, you know, Abe loves, you know, Trump loves to talk about his old, you know, his old, you know, his old friend and how much he misses him. But in practice, you know, if he missed him that much, would he, you know, would he be doing stuff like this? So,
right.
They, you know, there's a lot of bad feeling about that. And so, yeah, I mean, I think the discussion in Tokyo now is we need something in writing. Like, we can't just, you know, assume. And now we hear, you know, Bessent's been saying that if, you know, there's, you know, unhappiness with, you know, the trading partners, you know, holding up their end of the bargain, that they could snap back, you know, at any time. And so it feels progressively feels less like a victory. And of course, then you also have this massive question with this deal where, you know, the U.S. is talking about how, you know, Japan promised, you know, $550 billion of investment.
Oh, yeah, the Truth Social post. Yeah.
And the U.S. is getting, you know, Trump gets to decide how it's invested, and the U.S. gets 90% of the profits. And basically in Tokyo, they're like, that's not what we, you know, we like have like loan guarantees and some other things from public financial institutions that could possibly total up to $550 billion. No idea what the time frame on that is. You know, no idea. Like, you know, there's like pushback at this idea that the U.S. is taking 90% of the profits. I mean, it's just, I mean, the Japanese government's explanation of this, well, one, there's still not a whole lot of details, but very much pushing back at this notion that we've heard from, you know, official, you know, White House spokesman, Trump himself, Lutnick, that like basically Japan is like handing like a $550 billion check, you know, like do what you want. Like, they've been very clear that that's not what's going on here.
Right.
But we don't actually know.
Gotcha.
So,
well, I think that's really useful context in general. All right, Tobias, I think we're out of time, but I know there's a lot more that we could pull on here. But I want to thank you for coming on the show to talk to us. Tell our listeners a little bit about where they can find your writing.
Yeah, so I write a Substack observing Japan that try to update at least two or three times a week. Paid subscribers get a nice little digest of kind of the biggest stories and just try to get a granular look at what's happening. Do plenty of writing though for just free subscribers. So there's plenty of writing there to read. I am pretty regularly now in Nikkei Asia, usually about once a month. So you can find me there. Yeah, just out there talking and writing about Japan. So you can find me in a lot of different places.
Fantastic. Well, thanks a lot for joining me, and I'll look forward to having you back on in the future. Thank you. For listeners, make sure you subscribe so you can catch up with future episodes of the Asia Geopolitics podcast. And if you've been a subscriber for a while, but you haven't yet left us a review, please do that. You can do that anywhere you get your podcasts, and we really appreciate it as it helps us grow the show. Thanks a lot for listening, and we'll be back soon with more.